Labor Day. Happy Labor Day. All that. Now we start. Start your clocks now. I think one of the things that Americans struggle with is this tension between being affluent, and as a nation, we're a very affluent people. Not everybody, but we're talking collectively here. When you think about what we have, we can think about the size of the houses we live in. When you think about some of the luxuries that we enjoy, we don't call them luxuries, but things like microwaves are luxuries. Most people don't have them, and they're not really needed, but they sure make things go quicker. When you think about our luxuries, when you think about the safety, when you think about the living standard that we have, we might be the wealthiest nation to ever exist. Now, I realize there's issues related to inflation and comparison to the people that you have or the other nations at your time, but we may, and I think we probably are the wealthiest people to ever exist when you start to measure us by things like square footage and the amount of toys we own and the things that we have access to that are free. And so, because of that, rightly so, we don't want to be whiners. We work, I think, collectively, not everybody, but collectively, we work hard not to be people who whine about things. In fact, we talk about first world problems. And we say that with a laugh because we realize that a lot of the things that are problems for us, you know, other people would laugh at us that would be a problem, you know. Oh, I'm out of coffee this morning. I'm going to have to stop on the way to work and get coffee. I ran out of coffee. First world problem, you know. Oh, I forgot to take the trash down to the corner, and now I'm going to have to put it in my car, and I'm going to have to actually haul my own trash to the dump. And then, of course, if you're like me, you forgot you put it in there, and you go out at 5 o'clock, and hey, your car stinks, and then you got to, you know, deal with that. But it's a first world problem. Went to the grocery store, bought groceries. On Tuesday, found out Wednesday, boar's head might be contaminated. What am I going to do with all of this meat that I got? Should I risk it? And my wife doesn't listen to the news. Should I let her eat it and see what happens? And then, or should I just feed it to them? What am I going to do with all this boar's head meat in my refrigerator? It's a first world problem. And we say that because we know that the vast majority of people who have ever lived, and probably the vast majority of people that are living now, are dealing with, you know, 5 or 10 big issues. It's clean water, it's food, it's housing, it's clothing, it's very rudimentary health care, it's refrigeration, it's sanitation, it's getting some form of education, it's transportation, and it's just not affording those things, because we're struggling with affording some of those things, but it's just getting those things. They're just not available and haven't been available to billions of people who have lived. And again, we're over here and we're struggling with getting the right sleep number on our Tempur-Pedic. So we realize we should just sort of shut up and quit whining about our problems. But there are problems that are unique to our culture that everybody doesn't struggle with. And while we're telling ourselves, I need to be thankful, I need to look beyond some of these issues because other people that weren't part of this culture, they wouldn't understand. While that's true, there are, again, things that are hazards to living in the culture that we live in because of the complexity of it. And one of those things is being emotionally weary. Weariness. I think there are people, maybe even in this room, I know there are people in this town who would say something like this. I know I have a nice house, and I suppose that if I can get high enough, 30,000 feet and see everybody, I got a better house than most of the people that are living today. I have nice cars. Our family picture looks nice. We all look good. We all look healthy. We got nice clothes. We look like we've got a good situation. And we do have a nice situation. And I have a very nice job, but here's the problem. To keep all of this going, I have to go and I have to perform at a very high level. And there's no end in sight. My life, I get it, it's nice, but it's sort of like the old movie Speed, where somebody puts a bomb on the bus, and when the bus goes over 50 miles an hour, the bomb was activated, and if it drops below 50 miles an hour, the bomb blows up, and it's not miles per hour that my life is running at, but you might say it's dollars per hour, and if I don't maintain the speed that I'm running at, my life sort of blows up. And I get how people would be envious of my situation, but I'm sort of like the mouse on the exercise wheel, and the exercise wheel is very pretty, it's very nice, it's very shiny, that's my life. But I'm on the wheel, and if I stop running, everything sort of blows up in my existence. I mean, I can't go 3 months without a paycheck, and I probably can't go 3 weeks without a paycheck, and I get that my life looks great. I get that it looks wonderful, but I am weary because to maintain what I have to continue running, and I can't quit. I think there are people my age, maybe men more so than women, but maybe not, because I can't think like a woman. But I know men my age, and many men would say something like this in private while we're sitting around drinking coffee or something. Coffee, water, but not those other. While we're just sitting around communing, they would say something like this. At this point in my life, you know what my dream job would be? Something like forklift driver. That'd be great. Yeah, I just get to drive a forklift all day. I get to move this stuff over here. I get to load trucks and talk to truck drivers and they always have interesting stories. If I could, at this point in my life, or maybe drive a dump truck, that'd be cool too. But if I could just drive a forklift all day long, that would be great. Enjoy driving a forklift. But again, the problem is, I can't afford my mortgage on the salary that I think a forklift driver makes. And my wife isn't going to want me bringing home what a forklift driver makes. And I'm not going to be able to afford what my kids are doing on a forklift driver's salary, because I got three of them in sports and they all coming home with that calendar which says, you know, adopt a day, one out of 30, and if you adopt day 30, you got to give $30. And I've added it up, it's like $450. And when the first kid brought it home, I got all my friends to do it, but when the second and third one, now it's an issue of me losing my friends if I keep posting this stuff, so I got to just cough up the money or lose my friends if I keep asking them for money. So I got all this stuff going out. And I'd love a sort of a simpler life, but I'm not going to get a simpler life. It's not as easy as saying, well, I'll downsize and I'll get another house. You've seen the economy. It's not that simple. I'm driving that bus and I can't drop below a certain speed limit. I can't drop below this place. I think a lot of people are weary. I think there are people who are in marriages and they're weary with the marriage. Because, I mean, we can talk about true love and love wins out. And I know all the books say it's easy to fix. But it's a complicated world. When you're married with children, you're juggling a lot of different things. And if you have a marriage where people aren't so good at juggling a lot of different things, and if you have a marriage where on top of that people's personalities aren't so compatible after all, you're in a situation where it is a daily fight to get the most basic things done that create a functional household. You got to get Jimmy there and Sally there and Johnny over there. You got to get the house clean. You got to get the dishes done. You got to get the laundry done. You got to juggle the work. And if you got two jobs, and you're in that situation, and you know you got two people that aren't all that functional, and they're trying to make this thing work. And the problem is divorce only makes it worse. If you were to get a divorce, now you got to double your income because you're going to have two houses, and Johnny and Sally and the little one, they still have to go to everything they got to go to. It's actually going to get worse if you have a divorce, but it feels like what we're doing isn't sustainable in the moment. And that creates weariness. I mean, you're in that will, and you can't get off of it. I think there are people who have health issues, and it feels like that. I was thinking about Gene Shepherd, who was a great man, attended this church for over 50 years. I really liked Gene. Gene would sit back over in here. Gene had a rare form of leukemia, and he fought that thing for 7 years, and I think anybody else would have fought it for 7 months and given up. But Gene's life was build the white blood counts up, go get treatments, tear them down. Build them up, tearing. For 7 years, it seemed like it was all about building up the white blood count, tearing it down just to survive. And he got very weary at the end because I've got a situation, it's tough, and I can't get out of it. No way out of it. And because of the complexity of our culture, I think there are a lot of people who are weary. They're weary to the bone. They're where Lincoln was near the end of the war when somebody said, "You look tired. Why don't you take a nap?" And he said, "A nap won't fix what I got going on. The weariness is too deep inside." And if you can identify with any of this, I think Psalm 55 is for you. I'm not going to read it all because it's a more lengthy psalm, but I want to read to you five verses very quickly. This is a psalm of David. And in verse 4, David says, "My heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fearfulness and trembling have come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. So I said, 'Oh, that I had wings like a dove! I'd fly away and be at rest. Indeed, I would wander far off and remain in the wilderness, Selah. I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and tempest.'" Now, there's a immediate context to that passage, and that is probably the rebellion of Absalom. But I think that you see what some of you feel there. Here's David, and he's on the throne. And nobody would pity David because David has everything that his society would have said and our society would say that you need to be happy in abundance. David is the most powerful man in the kingdom. He's the king. David is by far the wealthiest man and one of the wealthiest men to ever live. David is the greatest musician of his day. He is a poetic genius. David is loved by lots of women, and even the women that he's not married to, you know, he has his pick. David has everything. And not only that, he is loved by God, and he loves God. So he has spiritual credentials. It's just not the material, but David's got it all, except one thing. David can never quit. Kings in that day aren't allowed to retire and to live happily ever after. It's well known that if you were to retire, you would almost certainly be signing your death warrant. In fact, when another king would come to power, it was just established conventional wisdom that everybody that was part of the king's family that you overthrew has to die. There can never be any time where two people have a claim to the throne. And if you retire and you go off, there's always the chance in 3 years you come back well refreshed and say, I'm ready to be king again. And that can't be. You can't have two people who might have a claim to the throne, or you can have a civil war. So David has everything except the option to quit. He has to stay on the will. And there's a throne on the will, but it's still a will that has to keep spinning. He can't walk away. Even now, in our culture, we have presidents that sort of, we haven't never had a president that would try to come back and be a dictator. We have never had that issue in our culture. So even when they're finished, they're finished. But for the rest of their lives, they have to travel with a bodyguard. And they weren't even kings. Because when you're the president, you do things that make people want to kill you. And that's the problem with a king. You have to make decisions and you make a lot of people mad in the end. So here's David, and he's got everything except the option to quit. You think about his day. I mean, one of the things he had to do was he was the Supreme Court in his land. And so there he is day after day, you know. There's Hezekiah and Jubal. They're fighting over the property line. David's got to hear all that stuff. There's a Miriam. Miriam's been accused of being a spy for the Philistines. And David's got to figure out what we're going to do with Miriam and whether it's true or not. There's Hezekiah. And Hezekiah owns property. And he's built a dam on his property. And he stopped the water flow in the Gilead. And David's got to figure out what to do with Hezekiah in the Gilead situation. And there's always a famine, and there's always a tribe that's encroaching the border, and there's always international issues. There's always somebody putting men on the border like they're about to invade. And then he's got all his family stuff, and there's no way to get away from it. It's there. And David says, I'd like to be like a dove and just fly off into the wilderness. He's not saying, I want to be an eagle. He's not saying, give me strength. He's not praying for strength. He's praying for rest, but he can't get it. Clovis Chappell, preacher of a former generation, imagines that what David is really praying for when he says, I just want to be a dove that flies off into the wilderness. I want to make my home over there. He thinks that maybe David is saying, listen, I want to go back to where I was born and raised. I want to exist before the kingdom, before the crown, before the parades, before the conquest, before Abigail, before Michal, before Goliath. I wish I could just go back to when I was a boy leading sheep around in a field without a care in the world. You would think with everything I have, I could just get back to that simpler time without the burdens of the world being on my shoulders. But he can't. He can't. The will has to keep spinning until he lays down on his deathbed. That's when it stops for him. And so it's a throne room, but it feels like a prison to him. And so you look at the passage and say, well, that's about lousy as it can get. But if you can identify with this, I want to just pick out two or three things here in this passage. And that took a lot longer to do than I thought. I thought I was going to do that in 7 minutes, and it took me 19 minutes. Oh, here we go. I'll move very quickly. One of the things David points out, or I think comes from this passage, is if you are weary and you know you can't get off the will, one of the things you ought to ask yourself is this: am I doing a good work? Am I doing a good work? Here's David, and all through this 55th Psalm, he's fighting evil men, and they're destructive people, and they're violent. And so at the very least, David can say, what I'm doing really is worthwhile, because if I wasn't carrying this load, somebody evil would be overrunning my country. I'm the great dam against evil coming in to the life of this nation because there's evil men, destructive people all around me. And so at least David can say, what I'm doing is worthwhile. This is important, what I'm doing. You know, Galatians 6:9 says that we ought not grow weary in doing good. And that implies you can grow weary in doing bad. And that's a bad kind of weary. If you're going to grow weary in doing good. I mean, what's bad weariness? Well, bad weariness would be, you know, you're such a controlling person, and it's got to be done your way. So here you are doing the work of four people because nobody can work with you. You're that controlling. That's bad weary. Or you're a very angry person, and the people who would help you, you drive away. There you are, you're a single mother, you got two kids, and your mom babysits for you, and your mom has the gall one day when you pick up your kids to tell you that you could do a little something better as your mom, and you lose it, and you get mad, and you say, you'll never see your grandkids again. And there you are, and now you got to do it all yourself. That's bad weariness, man. That's bad weary. You're weary because you're an angry person, and it doesn't matter what people do for you, they can't tell you anything, so you're an angry, chip-on-the-shoulder kind of person. That's a bad weariness. Materialism leads to bad weariness. There are people that they're weary because they got six different credit cards that have been run up to the hill because their eyes are really big, and it is weary, man. Debt is weary when you're just saying, I got to make the minimum amount of payments. I got to keep the wheel spinning, and there's no way forward. That's sort of a bad weary. Addiction's a bad weary. Addiction's a bad weary where you're here from morning to evening. There's this thing churning inside of you, and it's robbing you of so much, but you feel like you got to feed that animal inside of you. That grows very, very wearisome. There's bad weary, but there's good weary. I mean, if you're doing something worthwhile, remember when Nehemiah was building the wall, and it was hard, and it was criticism, and I mean, building a wall around Jerusalem, how hard is that? And his critics wanted him to come down and have a chat, and he said, I can't because I'm doing a good thing. I'm doing a good work. Maybe wore out, but what I am doing is worthwhile. It's helping people. You know, being a father or a mother, going to a job that even you don't like, that's tough, but you're doing it to keep up a family and to make the life better of your family, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. The stuff you do around the house, keeping a household up, that's a good thing. The work you do for the Lord is not in vain, the Bible says. That's a good thing. Coaching teams, making a difference in the life of children in your community, that's a good thing. There are good things, and if you're doing a good work, at least you're doing a good work. At least you're not weary and tired doing something that doesn't matter in the end. Or because you've got a character flaw that is causing you to have to do more than you should have to do on your own. Is it a good work that you're doing? David at least can say, it's a good work I'm doing, man. If I wasn't doing this, this nation would be in lousy shape. Secondly, do you have good people in your life? Good people make the difference sometimes when you feel weary. Again, David didn't have a lot of good people in his life at this moment. I mean, this is really an incredible time in David's life because here he is, and we know him as the greatest king in Israel, one of the greatest monarchs to ever live. And yet, the nation, the majority of the nation has sided with his son Absalom against him. And they just don't want him off the throne. They want him dead. And so many people that David had trusted and were in his inner circle have turned against him. They seek his life. And here is Here is David, and the Bible says Absalom got the following because he would sit outside the courthouse where David would hand down rulings, and he would look at the people who lost the case and said, you know, if I was a judge, I'd have done that different. You got ripped off. My dad doesn't know what's going on. And so the reason the people follow Absalom is because they think his wisdom is greater than his father's David's. This is a rough situation for a monarch. This is a rough situation for this great man of God. He doesn't have many friends, but I think he had a few friends, and that helps. If you got bad people in your life, you need to have a lot of good people in your life. Remember when Moses is there in Exodus 17, and they're in the valley of Rephidim. I think it's Rephidim. I could say anything there, couldn't I? You don't know. Thanks, the valley of Rephidim. And they're fighting the Amalekites, and God says, you go up on the hill, as long as you hold your hands up, Moses, your army will win. Your hands drop, your army's going to lose. Just a crazy thing to say, but this comes from the Lord. There's Moses, he holds his hands up, but, you know, how long can you hold your hands up? Some of you can't keep them up to the first song. how long can you hold your hands up? And finally, some people have to come and they just have to hold his hands up. It's like a rotation. Hold their hands up. By the way, if you want to worship God but you can't keep him up, we'll find some people. We'll help you out, man. But who have you got to hold your hands up? Some of you are single, and the rest of you, it's too late. You're serving your life sentence. There ain't nothing you can do. There you are. But some of you are single, and you have the ability to think through marriage. And listen, you need to find somebody. When you think about who you're going to marry, somebody who can hold your hands up when you're weary. Find somebody who has the capacity. Listen, guys, you got to look past the lips and hips. You got to find somebody. I mean, listen, when you go to buy a car, I mean, if it's got fat wheels and bright headlights, that's okay, but it's what's under the hood that matters. You're buying what's under the hood. And you got to find empathy under the hood. You got to find gratitude under the hood. You got to find somebody with a work ethic under the hood who can stand there with you and will be grateful and encourage you on the rough days. And that goes for women too. If you don't find that person, there's a chance that you're going to be married, and once the honeymoon wears off, you're going to be standing there and you're going to have an oblast moment. And it's going to be oblast. I'm in this thing by myself. I'm married to an extremely self-centered person, and they can spend it faster than I can make it. They don't clean it, even if I buy it. They don't want to be a parent, although they thought having kids would be fun. Makes them really stupid. And it's like, oh, blast. I'm in this thing by myself, and there's nothing I can do about it. You better find somebody who can hold your hands up. You better look under the hood. You better look deep into what kind of person they're going to be. And here's, again, David. He can't get off the golden exercise wheel. But I think he probably had some people in his life. I think that at least he could say, I'm doing a good thing, man. I'm doing a good thing. And then third, it's a very simple sermon. Strike me how simple it was till I started preaching it. Are you doing a good work? You have good people. Thirdly, have you got God? Got God. Look at this passage on down. David says this. As for me, again, I can't get off the wheel. I mean, I'm not going to get a vacation. I got to keep going. But as for me, I'll call upon the Lord, and the Lord shall save me. Evening and morning and at noon, I will pray and cry aloud, and he will hear my voice. This is what David's saying. He's saying, when I get up, I pray in the morning. I pray throughout the day. I pray in the evening. I pray at noontime. I just spend my life praying and saying, Lord, help me. Help me, Lord. And you know what? I get to the end of the day, and I find out I made it to the end of the day. He saves me. And then listen to what he says in verse 22. He says to you and I, cast your burden on the Lord, and he will sustain you. He shall never permit the righteous to be moved. Now think about that. He says, you and I have to learn to just cast our care on the Lord. What does it mean to cast your care on the Lord? I mean, that sounds like, you know, something somebody tells you in the hospital and nobody knows what it means. You know, just cast it on the Lord. Put it on the Lord. I don't know what to do. How do you do that? But look at the 1 Peter chapter 5. He tells us how to cast it on the Lord. He said, likewise, you younger people, submit yourself to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, for God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Now, that's a single thought, and this is what the thought is. If you'll humble yourself, humbling yourself is how you cast your care on the Lord. If you'll humble yourself, because God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble, and if you'll remember that he's got a mighty hand, you don't have a mighty hand, but he's got a mighty hand, as you're doing that, that is the equivalent of casting your care on God. How do you do that? Well, as you're praying, you say, Lord, I'm mortal, I'm human. Anything I know, it's because you taught me. Anything I've accomplished, it's because you brought me. Everything I am is flawed without you. I don't have the wisdom. I don't know the direction. I don't have the strength. I don't know my right hand from my left hand unless you show me. As far as I can tell, I don't have any reason to be proud, so I'm not proud. If anything gets accomplished, it's you. I don't have the ability to sustain myself today, but I'm reaching out to you morning, noon, and evening, and I'm relying on you to get me through this day. That's casting your care on him, just completely humbling yourself and saying, it's all up to you, Lord. It's all up to me. It's going to be a mess. It's all on you. Just give me strength for this moment. It's interesting there. He says, if you do that, he will sustain you. And David knows of which he speaks. He will sustain you. The word sustain there is a homonym. It's a Hebrew homonym, which means it's a word that has two different meanings to it. It's a word kol in Hebrew, and it's like an English word like bark and bark. Bark can be what a dog does. It can be something on a tree. Peer can be, you know, looking at something, or a peer can be a coworker. We have dozens of homonyms in the English language, and this is a Hebrew homonym. And so about half the time you see it in the Bible, it means to hold. And so David could be saying, Lord, when I cast my care on you, it's like you pick me up and you hold me. Or maybe he's even like saying, I'm standing there and you're holding me up. I'm able to stand, not because of the strength in my legs, but because your mighty hand is just holding me up. You've done that for me, and I have felt the power of your hands around me, holding me when it felt like my knees would buckle. You hold me. You sustain me. But it also means to feed, means to hold and feed. And maybe that's one image. Maybe the picture is that of holding a baby and feeding it at the same time. But it also means to feed. So it can mean that you give me what I need. I mean, when I'm weary and my soul is hungry, you feed me. When I feel dry, when I feel like I can't continue, to stay on this throne and go forward. And when I think about the next 20 years, I don't think I can do it. But day by day, you give me daily bread. You give peace. You give meaning. You give purpose to my life. You make it all worthwhile. I'm able to lay down at night, and I'm weary, and I'm tired, but I feel your favor on me, and that makes it all worth the while. You feed my soul at its deepest level. Here's David again saying, I can't get off. I can't get off the throne. I'm on the will. I would love just to be a dove and to fly away to a peaceful setting and be all by myself in a cabin and walk with the sheep and go through the woods and pick flowers. I would like for that to happen, but that's never going to happen for me. But what I'm doing matters. And I got some people around me, I believe, that can hold up my hands and can give me strength. And I have a God that I pray to morning, noon, and night. And when I don't think I can stand, he holds me up. And when I get through at the end of the day, he feeds me, he puts his favor on me, and I'm able to get up the next day, and I'm able to do it again by his grace. It's a word for Americans today. It's a complicated culture. And thank God for those of you who are working. Working is something that the Bible encourages. And in fact, it demands and it commands us to be people who work. When we don't work, the Bible says that we put ourselves above God because God was a worker. He was a creator. And when you say, I'm too good to work, you're saying, I'm better than God. And you're not. We are called to be workers. And the Bible is filled with people who are workers. Workers. I mean, Jesus was a carpenter up until the time that he went into ministry. All of those great, faithful people in the Bible, they're not prophets. A lot of them are, but the majority are just people who were working and made a difference as prime ministers, as farmers, as ranchers. They were workers, and part of the reason they succeeded was because they had great work ethics. I'm glad you have good work ethics. Some of you might feel weary. Will you stand today?